This is episode number 8 with Alina Gorgorian. Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. Welcome back to the Rise Higher podcast. I have got a special episode for you guys today. Now, in the very first episode I created, which was EP 0, I introduced what this podcast is and how it was inspired. And I shared in there how one of my intentions with this podcast is to raise awareness and decrease the stigma around mental health issues, and to provide support and tools for the people who struggle with their mental health to live an empowered life and to seek the help that they need. Well, this episode is the start of that. I have a very special guest today, Dr. Alina Gorgorian, who is a licensed clinical psychologist and the executive clinical director at Clearview Treatment Programs, which is where I ran coaching groups for 5 years. So in this episode, Alina gives a lot of great information about depression and anxiety, and she shares some skills that you can immediately put into practice to help with it too. Now, this is near and dear to my heart, because if you listen to episode number 5, in that episode, I shared about an intense car accident that I had earlier this year that triggered some mental health issues for me. And for 2.5 months, I was in a deep depression, and I was having suicidal ideations, and I was so pissed every morning that I woke up. And while I put on the mask that I was okay to pretty much everyone except 3 of my best friends, I was massively suffering inside, and I wasn't sure if I was ever going to get out of it. I mean, that freaked me out so bad, and while I had 3 amazing friends there for me, I still felt so alone and trapped inside of the pain. And you know, when I was coaching at Clearview, I worked with a population that struggled with deep levels of depression, and while I felt for them, I didn't fully get what they were going through. But after my experience with PTSD and all that came with it, my compassion for those who struggle with mental illness expanded way, way more. Now, one of the amazing things that I benefited from working at Clearview is I absorbed a lot of the therapy that they were teaching their residential clients, which was DBT, or Dialectical Behavioral Therapy. And Alina talks more about what that is in today's episode. And you know, I'm so glad that I had some DBT skills to use to cope and to get through each day during that dark time. Now, through other forms of treatment, thankfully, I was able to get out of my depression. And as I've reflected many times back to those months, I know that it's those skills I had that I was willing to use that made a huge difference in having me get through each day and to choose to stay. So it's such a gift to have Dr. Alina Gorgorian here on the show. Again, she's a licensed clinical psychologist. She received her doctoral degree in counseling psychology from Fordham University in New York. She's received extensive training and specializes in the delivery of evidence-based treatments, including cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, dialectical behavioral therapy, and acceptance and commitment therapy. Alina was intensively trained in DBT by Marsha Leinhans, Training Institute Behavioral Tech. She's worked as adjunct faculty at Pepperdine and Alliant Universities, and she's also given many trainings on a variety of mental health issues and evidence-based treatments nationally and internationally. Currently, she's the executive clinical director at Clearview Treatment Programs, where she trains and manages 15 therapists across 3 different programs. And Dr. Gregorian also has been in private practice since 2008, where she utilizes evidence-based cognitive behavioral therapies to deliver individualized treatment to individuals and couples. And her work focuses on changing cognitive and behavioral patterns to help clients make life changes, achieve goals, improve mood, and ultimately improve their quality of life. And she also provides professional trainings, workshops, and consultation services. And most of all, she is one courageous badass with a heart of gold. I absolutely love Alina, and I have a feeling you will too. So, in today's podcast, some of the things we cover are how to identify if someone is suffering from depression or anxiety and what you can do to support them, the cycle of depression and anxiety and ways to stop it, how to know if you should go on medications and the steps to find the right psychiatrist, alternative options and lifestyle changes you can make to support in overcoming anxiety and depression. And Alina gives specific practices and skills to ease and manage anxiety and stress. She openly shares her own personal process to release her anxiety of being on the podcast to show you exactly how to do them. And she also talks about how our core beliefs impact our automatic thoughts. And Alina teaches a couple powerful skills to start changing your thought patterns and counteract the negative thinking of depression, plus so much more. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I cannot wait for you to hear the powerful skills that Alina shares, because these work. I've worked them. And again, these skills are useful for anxiety, depression, and even stress. So if you're someone who stresses a lot, one of the main practices that Alina shares is incredible with managing stress. Now, for everything that we mentioned in today's episode and for the links to connect with Alina, you can check it out in the show notes. And that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP8. All right, here we go.
Alina.
Hi.
Hello. I'm so grateful that you are on the Rise Higher podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So you guys, I'm sitting here in Venice with Alina, who is an amazing human being. I had the honor and the privilege of working for and with her at Clearview Treatment Center. I really wanted to address mental health. I know I said that in episode 0, where I kind of gave an overview of what this podcast is going to be. And knowing tools and practices I know are so powerful and effective, and the best person I knew who could share her wisdom is Alina.
Yay.
So I'm grateful you said yes, even though I know you were
so nervous.
Yeah. So I would love for you kind of to share, because you're the clinical director at Clearview. What is a clinical director?
A clinical director is a licensed therapist who oversees the programs. And here at Clearview, we have 3 of them. We have our Women's Center, and we have a dual diagnosis co-ed. Both of those programs are residential. And then we also have a big outpatient program, and we provide a lot of different levels of care there. And so what I do is I oversee all of the programs. I supervise all of the therapists. I am involved in each client's care. I am involved in program development. I am involved in training and lots of other things.
Oh, big job.
A little bit. But I love it.
So with Clearview too, what populations do you guys work with?
So Clearview is really well known at this point. Clearview has been around for about 18 years now. And more recently, we've really become well known nationally and internationally for working with borderline personality disorder. With borderline personality disorder oftentimes comes depression and anxiety. So we're really treating those 3 things along with PTSD very often.
Yeah. And I know there's a specific type of therapy that you guys do here at Clearview. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, have you found to be the most effective type of therapies for people with, say, PTSD, anxiety, depression, or borderline?
So with anxiety and depression, I would say the gold standard treatment is really CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. For borderline personality disorder, it's DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. that was developed more recently than CBT. CBT's been around a long time. Marshall Linehan came around in about 93, developed DBT, which has really taken off, lots and lots of research supporting its efficacy. So DBT is the place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have coached in a couple other addiction centers as well. And I know when I've spoken to the clients there and asked them what's been the most effective for you in terms of all the different modalities. And so many of them also say DBT, hands down.
Oh, that's awesome to hear.
Yeah, DBT is just super effective for them because they're tangible skills really that they've been able to use to manage and regulate their emotions.
Exactly. That's what we do. Yes. Give them skills.
Skills. We all need skills. I know I need them sometimes.
For sure. It's helped me get through a lot.
Yeah. So I know that there's so much that you do with your work. And when you and I talked on the phone 3 weeks ago.
About.
Yeah, we were kind of formulating what would be the best thing to present today to support people. And the biggest thing is depression and anxiety is what a lot of people struggle with.
Right.
So knowing that, well, first of all, how can you tell if someone is struggling with depression and anxiety?
I'd say a few different ways. It really depends on the person. But I think if it's all about presentation, and it depends on how long they've been struggling with it. So if you've met somebody for the first time and they've struggled with depression and anxiety long before knowing you, it's going to be a little bit harder to tell. But if there's a marked difference in somebody that you know, their mood has declined, their ability to get stuff done in their lives and accomplish the things that they were able to accomplish before, get out of the house, be social, all of those things would be pretty clear signs. And of course, it could mean a lot of different things, but you've got to start asking some questions and see if they're okay and if there's a shift. If there's been a recent trigger, a recent life change, that might be something to look at as well and wonder kind of what's going on.
What kind of questions can you ask somebody? Because I think, you know, if someone doesn't understand really what it means to have depression or to experience anxiety, they might not know what type of questions to ask. What could you ask someone to kind of uncover more to see if they are really dealing with that?
I think one of the easiest things to say is, hey, are you okay? I've noticed you've been a little different lately. Just wanted to check in with you. It doesn't have to be anything profound, anything clinical. Mm-hmm. It's just checking in and saying, hey, I just wanted to say hi. Wanted to see how you're doing. I've noticed you haven't been coming out lately. I know how I get when I'm depressed, or I know how I get when I'm in a bad place. I just wanted to make sure you're okay.
Yeah.
And you don't stop.
And you don't just stop.
Yeah.
That's key. Because I know for some people, for them to actually admit it and be vulnerable to share, they may say yes immediately, or it might take a little bit.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that makes people reluctant to share is because they don't think people will understand. And it's true, a lot of people who haven't experienced it don't understand. They expect people with depression especially to just snap out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason. And the other is, you know, everybody asks, how are you doing? And a lot of people feel like people just ask and they don't really care. They don't really want to know. And so, or people have this cognition, this distortion that people don't really want. I don't want to burden people. If I tell them how I'm really doing, it's going to burden them and they don't want to know. And everyone's got their own stuff that they're dealing with. So I think if you keep coming back and if you keep making yourself available, and even if you make yourself vulnerable, and let them in on what you've experienced, it just opens the doors for people to share.
Yeah. I feel like it's more common than it is not to experience some form of depression or anxiety. So being willing to share your own experience, I know I had mine earlier this year that was really tough. And what you had mentioned in terms of people actually understanding you and wanting to share, because I did share with a couple people the deep depression I was in, and, you know, I was having suicidal ideations and I was invalidated a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I was told, oh, well, tomorrow it'll be better. And I was like,
the worst thing for someone with depression to hear.
Yeah. So what would you say, right? Because if someone doesn't understand it, and even one of my other best friends, she actually has BPD, and she calls me because she knows that I can handle it, or I know how to speak to her. And one of her other closest friends does not get it and is actually in denial that she has any form of mental illness.
Yeah.
So if you don't understand it, but you can kind of see someone has signs of depression or anxiety, what could you actually say that would support them instead of them feeling invalidated?
I think it really depends. There are different kinds of depression, and there are so many different levels of depression and different levels of ability to function with depression. So it really depends. I think, though, you've got to start with just listening and getting a sense of what the person is experiencing, what your friend is going through, what's causing it. Is it situational? Is it chemical? Has it been longstanding? Is it something they've experienced all their life? All of these different factors influence what somebody can hear. Mm-hmm. And so I think first things first, just start with listening and asking questions, letting them know what you've been through, letting them know that they're not alone, letting them know that you're not going to judge. And once they start talking, then you take it from there and you really get a feel for how ready, willing, and able they are to get help before you start mm-hmm. giving them either advice or resources. For me, what I've always noticed personally with friends is letting them know what I've been through and what's worked for me. Mm-hmm. And I kind of take a step back and take a look at whether they're showing interest before I move forward. I think it's particularly hard for me because everyone will be like, you know, you're not my therapist. My friends will say, put your therapist hat.
Take it off.
Check it at the door. We don't want that. Mm-hmm. For me, I've got to be really careful before I even attempt to give any advice or resources. I just do a lot of listening and sharing and then take it from there.
In case people don't know, what's the difference between the depression and the anxiety? If you have one, do you have the other or not? Like, just so people can pinpoint the difference and how it impacts their life.
They do oftentimes go hand in hand. When you experience a lot of anxiety, a lot of debilitating anxiety, that often leads to depression. You know, you're avoiding so many things in life. You're avoiding seeing your friends. You're avoiding seeing your family. You're avoiding going to work. You're avoiding applying for jobs, let alone interviewing for jobs. So you're really not getting to live the quality of life that you really want. Mm-hmm. And so those things can lead to isolation and depression. And when you're depressed, you end up avoiding a lot of things. And the more you avoid, the bigger anxiety gets. So the two really often do go hand in hand. It doesn't mean that you always have them together. But the signs they're somewhat different and can sometimes look the same too. But with depression, you have a lot of just low mood. You're sad. You're feeling a lot of worthlessness and hopeless around things getting better. You are sometimes feeling suicidal, not always. You can't sleep. Your sleep patterns are off. Either you're sleeping too much or you can't sleep at all. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of rumination about things that you're worried about or things that you're unhappy with. There's changes in appetite, mm-hmm. so things like that. And then with anxiety, it can be all of those things too, especially rumination, racing thoughts. You feel like you can't control your thoughts or you can't stop your thoughts, feeling a loss of control, panic, heart racing, palms sweating, things like that. Panic attacks. People will have panic attacks.
Yeah. I know there's different levels of it, as you mentioned, of like depression as well as anxiety. Some people experience higher levels of it. Some people just, it's more mild. Mm-hmm. Is this something that is curable?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can ask a lot of people who will tell you that they suffered in the past with depression and anxiety. But the thing about these things is that they can always come back. Just like cancer can come back. You can be in remission for many years and it can come back. So you can utilize really effective treatments that during which you learn skills, and then you try to make a habit of using those skills. And then sometimes they fall away. Everything's a habit. You can start working out. You work out for 6 months and then it falls away a little bit. Life happens and then it's hard to get back on. And it's the same thing with skills, but you try your best to make it a habit and life practice. And as you do that, either it reduces the likelihood of the depression and anxiety returning, or if and when it does return, it returns at a lower intensity.
Mm, that's beautiful. And probably being able to move out of it faster if you have the skills. You know, something, and I just want to give her a shout out. I'm not going to say her name, but one of my, closest girlfriends who has BPD, she is such a warrior because she got close to wanting to attempt mm-hmm. to commit suicide. And that's when she really got the help that she needed. And she learned DBT and has worked the skills like crazy. Oh, she's awesome. Not on any medications. She, you know, is a boss at what she does. Yeah. And even though she has those moments where she dips and she says, it's my borderline kicking in, it's mm-hmm. so beautiful to witness her actively using her skills and seeing her live a life worth living.
Yeah.
And she says it. She just said it to me the other day. She's like, I actually have a life worth living now. And from when I met her to where she is, it's just such a testament to if you take these skills of DBT, CBT and practice them,
yeah,
you can actually, you know, move above and beyond the debilitation of the depression, anxiety, and other parts of what the mental illness could be. So are people born, this is another curious question, are people born with depression and anxiety?
I think some people probably can be. There, people have been doing research on brain chemistry, brain anatomy, neurotransmitters, so chemical imbalances, so to speak. So some people could definitely be born with it, and others, there are lots of things that can cause it. There are situational factors that can cause it, life events that can cause it, life-altering situations that people just either don't have the coping skills or the support or the resiliency to cope through. And it causes long-standing, long-term depression.
I know we're going to, at the end, jump into some skills, but another thing that some people might need are medications.
Definitely.
So I would love to hear your opinion about taking medications.
I'm definitely for it. I can say I probably earlier on in my career didn't really, as I was really learning about this stuff, and I was a big, huge advocate of CBT, and I was like, CBT is everything. It's not, but it's a really effective treatment, and a lot of times you need treatment plus meds. And then after time, when people really, like we were talking about earlier, make this a life practice, sometimes they're able to come off of the medication, and sometimes they're not. Some people take medication for really long periods of time, if not forever. And that's okay too. Coming off of medication can be really challenging physically and emotionally. So you've just got to work with your psychiatrist and figure it out. But there's no right or wrong way to do it. You've got to just assess with a professional every step of the way and figure out what your needs are.
So I know a lot of people just, I mean, and also because I'm in such a high conscious community, so people are always like, oh, you can think your way out of it, or there's other alternatives because they're so into holistic healing. Mm-hmm. What would you say to those people for why medication is important? Because there's a lot of pushback that I know just from my community of going, you know, psychiatrists just want to push medication. Yeah. Is it really necessary? And I know you said it is, but just to kind of give a little bit more for why in some situations medication is important.
Well, I think if you've got someone who is severely depressed, not able to get out of bed, not able to shower, not able to brush their teeth, not able to get out of the house, those are the people who I bet you they have tried to quote unquote think their way out of it. And it's not for lack of effort. It's just not enough. And they need medication to help them with a starting point. The meds help a little bit and allow you to get out of bed, to get to your therapist's office, to do the rest of the work. And, you know, some people really need that first step. And that first step can be what you need for a long period of time, if not forever. And that's okay too. But for people who are severely depressed, the medication really, really helps. So I'm totally an advocate for meds, okay, if and when it's needed. And you've got, you know, a lot of people, what they do is they will get especially medication for anxiety and depression from their PCP. And that's what I might advise against, because they might know a little bit about anti-anxiety medications and about antidepressants, and that's great, and not to discredit any PCP, but they don't do a thorough psychiatric assessment to figure out what's going to work with you. It's not their scope of practice. It's not their area of expertise. And just like you wouldn't go to a psychiatrist for things that you'd need from an internist, the other way is true as well. So you want to go to a psychiatrist, one that you can spend some time doing an initial evaluation, explaining what you've been going through, talking about what you've tried, what's worked, what hasn't worked, to determine which meds. There are so many different types of antidepressants, and to really figure out what is going to work. And if it doesn't work, then you keep going back and reassess and trying out different things. Meds are not, you don't just try one med and it works and then you move on mm-hmm. with the rest of your life. Sometimes you've got to play with some meds to figure out what fits your body's needs. Mm-hmm. And I think a psychiatrist is much better suited to do that than a PCP or an internist.
How does somebody find the right psychiatrist for them?
First things first, I mean, resources have everything to do with it. So if you are utilizing insurance, you get in touch with your insurance, you get on your insurance website, you get on Psychology Today website, you start looking for somebody who will accept your insurance. And it's okay to interview a few people. And yes, you're going to have to pay the copay to interview them, but it's really, really important to do. This is important work, and you've got to find someone who you know is going to listen to you, who's going to take you seriously, who's going to be able to validate you, who is not going to be that person who just prescribes and pushes meds.
Yep.
And I have to say, to the credit of a lot of the psychiatrists that I know, I don't know of too many that really push meds. Psychiatry has really moved a lot in decades, and I think psychiatrists often get a bad rep. And there are some that might be less conscious or less mindful of the work. You know, there are those of us in all of our fields that might be that way. But you've got to interview people. You've got to interview people and find the person that you feel comfortable with. So if you're insurance dependent, which most of us are, you get on the website or call your insurance company. Word of mouth, asking around, asking for referrals, asking about people's experiences with psychiatrists. There are very few degrees between you and somebody who has seen a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. So you will find someone who has met with a psychiatrist before.
Let's say if somebody doesn't have a lot of connections, there are some people who maybe don't want to share or yeah. even ask their friends for a psychiatrist referral because they don't want to reveal mm-hmm. that they need that.
Yeah.
Are there any online forums or places that people can go to start doing their research
yes,
that you would
Psychology
recommend?
Yes, Psychology Today is a great website, and you just put your location and say what you're looking for, and you'll get a long, long list, and you can start calling them and start asking them some questions over the phone before you make the appointment. Mm-hmm. If somebody's not willing to answer any of your questions over the phone, then that might be a sign that that's not the right person for you. The other thing you can do is just call treatment centers. People are there picking up the phone, answering questions. And, you know, you're not going to find a treatment center that says, I don't know, and hangs up. You are going to find people on the other line that even if they can't admit you into their program, they're going to say, let me find you some referrals. And Clearview is one of them. We get calls all the time. And our intake counselors aren't...
They're so helpful.
They don't turn people away. And
yeah.
they look for... We have an outreach team. And we know about a lot of providers across the country. We provide referrals all the time.
Yeah, guys, I got to say, I mean, I'm so grateful that I worked at Clearview. It's such a top-notch program. Everything
Thank
is
you.
Done so well. And it's really incredible to witness, too, in the time that I was here, the clients coming through from where they first are when they are, yeah. you know, intake to discharge. Many of them, you see such a radical change in them and the hope reinstilled within them. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, Clearview is definitely a special place. And my Clearview team is family. And you can get a lot of the same effects with doing, you know, outpatient work. You don't have to come into a residential program, for mm-hmm. example. It's the DBT. It's the care. It's the passion. It's the knowledge mm-hmm. That every single DBT provider I've ever come across brings to their clients.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a big DBT advocate.
I know you love your DBT.
I do live and die by that.
So just curious too. So obviously medications are for mm-hmm. people who really have debilitating depression and anxiety. So people who experience more generalized depression and anxiety, are there alternatives to medicine?
Yeah.
Aside from, say, the skills yet, because we'll jump in there,
okay.
but things that they could do lifestyle-wise that might be supportive.
Lifestyle-wise, definitely. But let me back up for a sec. I don't think that you have to have severe, severe depression only in order to get on meds and for meds to work. You don't have to get to a place where you're suffering that badly to get on meds. If you've got depression and it's debilitating enough, and if you're comfortable with getting on medication, you should. There's nothing wrong with it. And then once you start the meds and get treatment, I wouldn't recommend doing medication only for anybody. Once you get the treatment and turn it into a life practice, then if you want to get off the meds, you can. And if you don't want to, you don't have to. But I don't want to say that it has to be absolutely severe before you can get on medication. Other alternative options. I mean, exercise has, there's so much research supporting exercise improving mood. And a lot of people use a lot of mindfulness. That there's a lot of evidence that mindfulness can help too. There's UCLA's MARC program, M-A-R-C, that you can look into, and they offer classes. And I've had clients take those classes, and they've said that it's helped tremendously. Yoga really helps, I would say. I mean, you know, some people have also used acupuncture. I don't have a lot of evidence behind that to support that, but I've heard about it. I think whatever you do, you've got to be bought into it. You've got to be open to it. You can try anything, and if you go into it without an open mind, it's just probably not going to work. But anything else that you are super open to and seeing where it goes, those are the things that I've heard can actually be really helpful in addition to skills.
Beautiful.
We'll get there.
Right, that's a perfect segue. Why don't we actually jump into skills?
Okay.
Where could someone start with practices to manage their depression or anxiety?
So probably the first place I would start working on any symptom is mindfulness. I think you've got to, anyone's got to really start with being aware of what's going on at any given moment, being able to focus on something intentionally and not just react, to know what to do. So mindfulness is the practice of being present with intention and accepting of a present moment without judgment. You really need to brush up on your skills to be able to do that, because what happens a lot of times is people will find themselves feeling very, very anxious without even knowing when it started, without knowing what prompted it. And so then they're in the thick of their anxiety, and it feels like quicksand and they can't get out of it. Whereas if you're using your mindfulness skills, if you're mindful of what's happening, then you get stronger and stronger at noticing the signs, noticing the anxiety slowly coming on, learning what your triggers are so you know how to either avoid them, how to prevent them. And sometimes you can't avoid them or prevent them at all, but you know what to do to manage the anxiety as you notice the triggers happen. So mindfulness is absolutely key.
So what are some mindfulness practices? Because I know there's so many of them.
So many, yeah.
But for someone who's starting out, and I think this is just, I love mindfulness. Mm-hmm. It brings me back to the present moment, so my mind's not spinning out of control or beating myself up, or when I get into self-doubt and just those crazy thoughts that happen. But mindfulness has been a powerful tool I've used to just kind of stop and interrupt that and regulate my emotions. Where does someone start with practicing mindfulness?
I think you've got to start with an understanding of what it is. So doing some research and getting online. There's so many things online about mindfulness right now. But again, mindfulness is, people have this misconception, I think, about mindfulness that you have to sit in a quiet space with maybe candles lit in a lotus position. You've got to close your eyes and you've got to touch your middle finger to your thumb and, you know, all of those things. And some people, that's part of their mindfulness practice, absolutely. And it's such a calming, peaceful, grounding.
But when you're in the
do.
Middle of the grocery store and you start to getting
Absolutely.
Anxious, you cannot chill in the middle of the
it
aisle.
It doesn't work. You don't say, step aside, guys, I got to get in my lotus position. Give me a minute. That can be some people's mindfulness practice. It can be the start of some people's mindfulness practice, and it does not have to be at all. I practice mindfulness when I'm driving. I practice mindfulness when I'm eating. I practice mindfulness when I'm having my coffee. Lots of people do it with tea, but I just like my coffee better.
So break it down. When you're in your car,
okay.
How do you practice mindfulness in your car?
So like I'm going to do when I go home today, because I'm going to be sitting in about an hour and a half of traffic and my anxiety is going to go up. I am going to not drive on autopilot like most of us do. I'm going to get in my car. I'm probably going to take a deep breath. I am going to intentionally notice as I take my key from my hand and put it in my ignition and turn it. I'm not going to be staring at my phone, for example, when I am doing that. I'm going to be doing it with intention. I'm going to pay attention to it. I am going to do it deliberately. And that is the only thing that I'm going to be doing. I'm going to notice what the keys feel like in my hand. I'm going to notice what my wrist feels like as I turn the ignition. And then I'm going to listen to my engine start. And then I'm going to look at my rearview mirror, my side mirrors, my rear camera, and then I'm going to put the car in reverse and go. And I'm going to go slowly. I'm going to exit the parking lot. I'm not going to have the radio on. And I'm going to feel my foot against the pedal. And I am going to notice the cars in front of me and around me. And I'm just going to do that for probably about 10 minutes. Am I going to do it for the whole commute? Absolutely not. I think it's very challenging. Some people, some very remarkable people, can stay mindful and practice mindfulness for an hour and a half at a time. I'm not there. I'm not so enlightened, but I can do it for about 10 or 15 minutes. And the calm and the peace and the centeredness that it brings me in this moment is priceless to me and my life and my functioning and my sanity. And at the same time, doing that for 15 minutes will allow me to notice things happening internally and externally on an ongoing basis, so that when anxiety hits me, I've noticed it immediately as it comes on, versus finding myself in the middle of it because I am not skilled at being mindful, because I haven't developed and strengthened that muscle in my brain. So practicing it both helps you in the moment and helps you long term.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, mindfulness truly is just being so present in the moment, engaging all of your senses. And you know, our brain can only focus on one thing at a time. So if you're so present with the thing, the experience in the now, you can't think about all the thoughts that might cause the anxiety or the depression to kick in.
Exactly. When you're mindful of one thing, you are not mindful of other things. And that's a good thing.
That's such a healthy thing. Totally.
We're in a society where multitasking is such a skill. It's such a, you know, coveted skill, but oftentimes it's actually not. And oftentimes we've got to put everything away. Being mindful of driving is not being mindful of what's going on your phone. And it's not being mindful of what's causing you to be anxious about something. It's preventing you from ruminating on something because you're mindful of something else. And that's a great thing.
It's a really good thing. And guys, just what Alina said, I would totally encourage you to go and do some research, because there's so many different types of mindfulness practices. That's one. And I am declaring this right now, but I want Alina back on. I want you back on, girl, to keep sharing, because there's so much people can learn to really manage, you know, their inner
specific
struggles.
Yeah. And there are actually specific skills, next time I'm on maybe, that you use to get mindful too.
Yeah. Can you tell one?
Right now? I can tell you all six that I know.
All six. So here we go.
Three of them are kind of are what you do, and then the other three are how you do them. So the what you do, you've got to do stepwise. So first you observe. You observe through your senses. You look, you feel, you touch, you smell, you taste, you hear. And so you just take some time to just observe what's going on around you. And then once you've observed, then you describe. You put words to what you've observed. A lot of people just jump to describing. We're advanced beings, so we can do it. But when you first observe, your description skills are just much more enhanced. So observe first and then put words to what you've observed by describing. And then you participate with what you've observed and described. You throw yourself in and participate in ways that are going to work. But you don't know what's going to work without having observed first, described second, and then you finally participate. So, and I can give examples of that, but I'm going to go over kind of the how skills. So those are the what skills. Those are what you do. And then how you do them one mindfully. That means you do them just one at a time. And then you do them non-judgmentally. So you don't, this is a big part of mindfulness, staying in the moment, accepting the moment for what it is, not judging it as bad and not judging it as good either. We all want to judge everything as good throughout our lives, but just judging it for what it is. So you're doing it non-judgmentally, and then you're doing it effectively. You are doing what works. You're putting one foot in front of the other to do what works instead of how it should work, how it should be. What's justified, what's not justified, what's right, what's wrong. You're just doing what's effective. So if I'm in a social situation, if I'm talking to you, if I'm nervous about coming on here, for example, mm-hmm. I get mindful. I observe what's going on inside of me, inside my body, if my heart's racing, if my palms are sweaty. Those are the senses that I pay attention to, is my heart racing. So I just kind of sit and I observe what's going on. And then I say it out loud. I say, or I don't have to say it out loud, but I put words to it. Heart racing, palms sweaty, nervous, feeling anxious. And then I've observed that, I've described it, and now I'm going to participate. I'm not going to avoid. I'm actually going to be here with you. I've got my phone sitting next to me, but I'm not looking at it. I may be anxious about how much longer we're going to talk because I'm, you know, my anxiety's there. I'm not going to look at my watch. I'm just going to be present and one mindful and participate here with you. I'm going to do it non-judgmentally. I'm not going to judge what I'm doing as good or bad. Right or wrong. I'm not going to think about the future and when I listen to this and how I'm going to sound. I'm just going to be right here in this moment. And I'm just going to listen to each of your questions and answer them. So that's me putting one foot in front of the other, not jumping too far ahead and not thinking back to the words that I've said before and judging myself for them. I'm just going to be right here, present, one mindfully, doing just this.
I love that. You're so mindful right now. And I was so mindful just listening to you. And yeah, it's really beautiful. Thank you for sharing what mindfulness is and the skills to, or the steps to, because again, you know, so many times people say, oh, be mindful. And then you're like, how the heck do I do that? And I'm such a big proponent of teaching the how of things, which is, you know, again, the whole intention of this podcast. It's not just saying, guys, go be successful. It's like, what are the steps? Or, you know, go be calm. And it's like, what are steps to create calm? Yeah. So I really love that you broke it down for us.
It helped me in this moment too.
Yeah. Are there any other mindfulness practices you can share?
So one of my favorites is Leaves on a Stream. You could probably find this on YouTube. You could probably Google it and find something written out that you could read to yourself and do. But the idea is, you know, the idea behind mindfulness is that you are paying attention, not controlling. So paying attention to anything coming into your consciousness. It could be a thought, it could be an emotion, it could be a body sensation, and you allow it to come in. And you allow it to go. You don't hold on to it by ruminating and obsessing over it and worrying about it. And so Leaves on a Stream is, it provides a visual to allow just that. And what I like to do is, again, you know, get in a comfortable position. You don't have to have your eyes closed. It doesn't have to be dark. You don't have to have candles on. You could be anywhere. And you imagine a stream. And then you imagine yourself with each thing that comes into your consciousness, say it's a thought, you take that thought and you imagine putting it on a big leaf, and then you put that leaf in the stream and you watch it go. So I'm having the thought that this has been so much fun. And
don't put it on a leaf.
But, you know,
keep it.
You know, and that's the thing. I could keep it, or if I'm practicing mindfulness,
totally.
I put it on the leaf and I let it go, because if I'm having that kind of a thought, another positive one is probably going to come right behind it. And that's really cool, too. But say if I'm having a thought, oh, my gosh, like I'm so hungry. Right. And there's a body sensation that goes along with that. And that's even harder. So you put the thought and you put the body sensation both on a leaf, and you allow them to come into your existence, and you allow them to go too. And then you come back to the present moment. That way you're not suffering by being so hungry. You're allowing it to come, and you're allowing it to go. And then you're noticing the next thing that comes. The next thing can be something so beautiful and joyous. So you're really allowing things to come and go. Come and go. And you're not trying to block them out. You're not trying to push them out of your existence. You're just letting them be without judgment, and you're allowing them to go too. There's another really good one that I just remembered. Mm-hmm. So picture yourself in a room with two doors, and the thought that you're having, or the body sensation, or the memory, whatever it might be, it's coming in through one door, and it's traveling through the room and exiting through the other door. So everything's just coming and going, not getting stuck. And you're not pushing to get unstuck either. You're just kind of maybe even imagining a wind, whether it's on the stream or even in that room. And it just kind of ever so gently blows the thought out. We do the same thing with balloons. Put a thought in a balloon and let go of the balloon, and it goes up into the sky.
As you've been describing, I'm feeling so calm already.
Yeah, me too.
I'm watching your hand gestures and seeing you describe. I'm like, oh, I just feel so calm right now.
It feels so good.
Yeah, it really does. What are some other skills that you could teach us right now that could be supportive if someone, again, might be kicking in with their anxiety or with depression?
This might sound crazy to people. And we didn't even talk about me talking about this, but skills to help your depression can be different from skills to help your anxiety. I'm going to talk about anxiety for a second. One of the things that I actually love to do while I'm getting mindful and finding some peace, and this is so counterintuitive, but something that helps me with my anxiety is accepting it.
Mm. And acceptance.
Just accepting it, allowing it to be there. Accepting it means allowing it to be there. Allowing it to be there means accepting it. And some people say, I just can't. There's no way. This is completely intolerable. And I can't manage it in my body. I can't manage it in my mind. And one thing that I do that really helps me, there's a visual to this, but I create a space in my body for it. And something I do is I take a deep breath, and we all know taking a deep breath can help in a lot of different ways. It just kind of slows things down. Along with taking a deep breath, I envision this place in my stomach, somewhere in my abdomen, for my anxiety to exist safely. Mm. So I'll take a deep breath and I'll just let the anxiety be there. And it sounds crazy. But once I've accepted it in there, I'm better able to manage it. I'm better able to acknowledge that it's there, accept that it's there, not do everything that I can think of to try to push it out of my system, because that takes up a lot of energy
too. That just makes it worse. It aggravates it and it holds it in place instead of releasing it.
You just hold it with calm, with peace, with a little bit of relaxation that taking that deep breath provides. And then you, again, go back to the mindfulness skill of one foot in front of the other. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing I do often with my anxiety.
So good.
And I've got to do it over and over again. It's not just this thing that I do and it lasts like all day or even...
I wish it did. Yeah, that'd be amazing. Like, let me start minutes, the morning with my quick mindfulness.
And then I'm solid for the rest of the day. No.
No, that's why they call it a practice.
Exactly.
You got to keep practicing it. And then you get more skill and eventually it's almost like a trigger. You can just... You know, maybe even just a vision, that safe spot in your belly, and boom, it's gone.
Absolutely. Know? It's manageable. I don't know if it's gone, but it's definitely more manageable. Mm-hmm. And it relaxes your body, because a lot of times our brains send messages to our bodies, but a lot of people don't know that our bodies send messages to our brain too. So if we're anxious, we're tense. Our tension then feeds right back to our anxiety in our brain. So calming your body, calming your face, the muscles in your face. We have this amazing skill that we call half smile. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to talk a lot about DBT skills, but I swear by this one. But just calming, relaxing all of the muscles in your face, and especially in your eyebrows, especially in your forehead, taking a deep breath, and then just ever so slightly and gently turning the corners of your mouth up. Just like that.
When you do it, it's awesome.
It's awesome. And people don't even know that you're doing it, but your brain picks up on it. Your body picks up on it so quickly. And it just lifts so much of the tension. And then it just provides a starting point to do some of the other skills. Mm-hmm. So mindfulness and half smile. Those are two. And breathing in and accepting the anxiety, creating a little nook in your abdomen for it to exist there, and then attempting some other skills from there.
So from there,
should we talk a little bit about depression and what we do for depression and anxiety too?
Do it, yes.
So in CBT, this is a big, big, big CBT intervention and skill. So you learn it in your session, in your CBT session, and then you practice it every day. We do a lot of what we call thought records or thought logs. And the idea behind that, well, first of all, the CBT model says that our thoughts, our behaviors, and our emotions are all tied together. One thing influences the others. So, and then there are situations. So, for example, my coming here today, right? You asked me to be on the podcast.
Yep.
And my thought could have been, well, a number of things, right? It could have been, oh my God, that is so exciting. And I can't wait to do it. And this is going to be so much fun. Sitting with Stephanie for an hour and just talking about what I do for a living is going to be amazing. So if I have that thought, my emotion is likely going to be excitement, is going to be happiness, it's going to be joy. And then my behavior is going to be launching right into preparing and scheduling it for as soon as possible and coming in here and being really excited and calm and present and animated like I am now. And I'm going to feel good. I'm going to feel really good about it. Now, I could also have the thought, which I did have, which is, oh, this is actually really cool, but oh my God, I'm actually so nervous about this. I've never done a podcast. I've done a lot of trainings and I've actually recorded one of them, but it makes me really nervous. It makes me anxious. What am I going to look like? What am I going to sound like? I actually had a really bad cold last week and I sound like I have a frog in my throat right now. Is that what they say, a frog in your throat? And so what am I inclined to feel if I have those kinds of thoughts? Worry, anxiety, self-doubt, and what are my behaviors going to be? Maybe saying, no, I don't think that's such a good idea. Maybe ask someone else. I've got a great person I can refer you to, I can recommend. Or saying yes and having to reschedule. And I did do that, but I really was sick.
Alina did that and I was like, she's avoiding.
Maybe I was, but I really was sick and I didn't want to cough in your mic. But so it really, so that's how your cognitions, your initial reaction to something, your initial cognitive reaction, what you think about a situation, your cognitive appraisal of a situation impacts your mood and impacts your behaviors, and your behaviors can impact your mood. So if I had let my thoughts impact my mood, my feelings, and then let my feelings impact my decision about doing this, then I was going to feel really bad about having said no, for example. Mm-hmm. And so having said no would have been a behavior that would have then fed into my thoughts, which it would have been like, oh, you're such a loser. Why did you say no? And just feel really badly about myself for having made that decision. And so the initial anxiety could then turn into sadness. So that's that loop. And it keeps playing itself out until you throw a wrench in it with a skill and you do differently. So I also want to say there are lots of different reasons that people have the cognitions that they have. So when you're responding to a situation, that's called an automatic thought. But we also have thoughts that are based on, you know, what we call core beliefs about ourselves, about mm-hmm. the world, about others. So some people's, a person's core belief about the world can be that it's unsafe. It's an unsafe place. And that is absolutely influenced by your life experiences. And core beliefs impact what your automatic thoughts are about situations that come up day to day.
You have repetitive thoughts based off of your core beliefs.
Yeah, there's a pattern.
That's why you have patterns in your life, because it just keeps reinforcing the core belief that you were conditioned with.
Exactly. And so what we do, the interventions in CBT really start with dealing with day-to-day stuff. That's a lot easier to tackle than a core belief that has been developed from a young age and, like you said, reinforced over and over and over again. So what we do is, in a thought record, we look at the situation and then we look at your automatic thoughts. What's the first thing you think? And based on those thoughts, what are the emotions that you experience? Based on those emotions, what are the behaviors that you are inclined? What are the behaviors you're inclined to engage in? And then I take it a step further and I ask my clients, if you were to engage in those behaviors, how are you going to feel about it afterwards? So we look at those things. And then so we really take a look at how can you change your thought patterns? And there are a number of Socratic questions, open-ended questions that the therapist and the client sit and talk about and talk through to generate an alternative cognition. A lot of people think that CBT is about coming up with positive thoughts. Drives me crazy when people say that. You can generate a new thought mm-hmm. that replaces your automatic thought. And that thought can be positive, but it's not always positive. What I'm looking for with my clients when I'm trying to come up with new thoughts is a more balanced thought. Not something that's completely negative, but something that is balanced with in reality. There could be some negative aspects of the situation, absolutely. But there could be some neutral aspects to it, and there could be some positive aspects to it. So coming up with a thought that is more neutral or more balanced, more based in reality, things like that. So in response to your request and of me coming.
Well, I remember what you said,
which
I loved when I called you and I asked you to be on the podcast, and you went, you're like, my first response is to say no, because it makes me nervous.
Yeah.
And you're like, but because I want to play in your world, I'm going to say yes and get out of my comfort zone and just do it. And I was like, yeah,
yes.
It was so good.
I had to use a lot of skills to be here. And I had to channel my inner Stephanie. I did, because I know exactly what you would have said. And I think of you often when I'm struggling. And, you know, I wanted to do this. And I live and breathe this stuff. And I didn't want my anxiety to get in the way. The first thought was, oh, my God, I can't do it. I'm not going to be good at it. Who's going to want to listen to me? But then I thought, okay, it's going to be hard. And it's going to cause me a lot of anxiety. And I know what I'm doing, and Stephanie's going to help me through it.
100%.
All of those things are true. So it was just more balanced, and it was more grounded in reality than my initial thought of, oh my God, it's going to be terrible and I'm going to suck. That's just not true. I hope it's not true. You guys
will let me
know.
It's not true.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But that's how you want. That's the kind of new thought that you want to generate. But there are lots of different ways to generate the new thought. So you ask yourself...
some of the Socratic questions, right?
Yeah, okay. Some of the Socratic questions. My favorite one that is a good one is, what would you tell a friend, right?
I love that one.
It's so true. We would never tell a friend what we tell ourselves. It's so unfortunate. We're so much better to other people than we are to ourselves. But what would you tell a friend? How would you help a friend come up with a more balanced response, mm-hmm. more balanced thought? And what's the worst that could happen is another one of my favorite questions. What is the worst that could happen? And what's the best thing that could happen? And then what's the most realistic outcome? So the most realistic, the worst thing that could happen is that I would have stuttered and I would not have been able to get my thoughts together. And I would have said, Steph, we got to stop. I can't do this. That would have been the worst case scenario. Best case scenario would be I'd come in and the words would just roll off my tongue and I would be just fine. And the most realistic outcome was I'd have a little bit of anxiety and we'd talk, and like we're kind of doing.
We're just talking.
And I was able to get there in my thoughts, which helped me to get here today.
Thank you also for using yourself as a personal example in this, because that's the beauty of what I really want to bring to this podcast too, is that level of authenticity that we're not alone. We all go through this stuff and
yeah.
have these thoughts that can kick in that fear, or that anxiety and that depression. But hearing you using yourself as an example to show that you can rise higher and overcome, you know, the moments that your anxiety is there, to be able to continue to move forward and provide so much value to, as you are on this podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I can teach the skills because I practice the skills. I practice the skills because they really work, and they work for everyone. You don't have to have high levels of anxiety and depression to use this stuff. It works for everyone, and I use it daily. I get my husband to use it daily, and if I can just get my dog to use it.
God, get that dog.
It's problematic.
Alina, you've given so much value today on this episode, and I'm so appreciative of you saying yes and using your skills to manage anxiety so we can actually make it happen.
Thanks for being patient with me while I work through that.
Of course. I got you. And I was so committed that you were going to be on, just because, again, I know you have so much knowledge, and for people who are struggling to have some skills at least to start to work with is going to be so powerful. And I know some of them have been such a good reminder for me to amp up my game with my mindfulness practices. So thank you for that.
Anytime.
But I definitely want to have you back on.
I was just going to say, I am so excited to be back on. I did not think I would say that. And I do want to do it again. So yes. And I was just thinking how I didn't avoid this, which is what allowed me to be excited to do it the next time. And the biggest thing about anxiety that we didn't talk about is the fact that we all avoid the things that we are anxious about. And what that does is it reinforces this idea that there's something to be so anxious and worried about. And so we don't do it. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing, the biggest intervention, the biggest skill in working on anxiety is to not avoid it. And so I'm glad I didn't avoid this. We can talk about that a little bit more some other time, I guess. We didn't get into it today.
Yeah.
But I didn't avoid it. And it let me know that I don't have to fear this. And it made the monster of anxiety a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be back on.
Yes. Yay. And just to reinforce what you said, I mean, when people do act based off of their feeling of anxiety and they avoid, mm-hmm. how much in life you miss out on,
yeah.
that could actually be so pleasurable and make life so much more fulfilling.
Yeah.
So using the skills to manage the anxiety so you can still take those steps forward to doing the things that you maybe thought you couldn't do and experiencing the joy on the other end when you do.
Absolutely.
So amazing.
I'm so glad I did that today.
Me too. So to close this out, I'm going to ask you three questions. This is the Unlock Your Heart round. Ooh. The first question is this. What's something unique about you that most people don't know?
Oh, I'm such an open book. I feel like everybody knows everything about me. Probably what I said a million times today, I have a lot of anxiety. I've had a lot of anxiety from my childhood. Yeah, I'll end there.
Okay. And when you're in a really dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
My dog, probably. Lots of times my dog.
Her dog's so cute, by the way, you guys.
So she's such a little troublemaker, but she's, and she's so cute.
And she's so cute. They get away with that because they're so cute.
Pets, animals, not just my dog, any animal.
Yeah.
They're just such a gift to me. Yeah.
And animals are such a powerful way to practice mindfulness too.
Oh, yeah.
You can't for me at least, same thing. My dog, it's just when I'm with him, I'm so present with him that a lot of...
They're so great.
Yeah. Those... crazy thoughts that happen up in my brain can disappear. So
you've got to be mindful with them. I've got to be like with my dog. She keeps me on my toes when I'm with her. So
perfect. So last question, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
Oh, it's going to be okay. what advice would I get? Yeah, that it's going to be okay. And that what you're feeling right now doesn't have to be forever. It can end up being forever, but it doesn't have to be forever. Try new things.
And you're doing it.
Try new things. I did. You're right. I totally did.
Yes. Alina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I adore you, and I can't wait to have you back on.
Thank you. I can't wait.
How amazing was that? I love all of the incredible information Alina shared and the powerful practices to support in managing and decreasing the feelings of depression and anxiety. Now remember, if you want to recondition new response patterns, this has to become a practice. And the more you practice mindfulness, the more you write out a thought record and work the other skills she shared, the more automatic it will become and the easier it will be to shift out of those fear-based feelings. Now, there's so much in life that can easily cause stress, anxiety, or those feelings of depression. So take control and take one of those skills in this episode and start practicing it daily. You know, especially doing a daily mindfulness practice is an absolute game changer to be present, to create more calm, and to have access to feeling good. If you want a cheat sheet detailing the skills Alina taught in this episode, I made one for you, and you can download your cheat sheet at stephaniekwong.com/skills1. And if you want an extra boost of empowerment from Alina, go check out my Instagram at @IamStephanieKwong, where I have a mini video of Alina sharing a powerful practice she uses to keep stretching and elevating in life. Now, if there's someone you know who could benefit from this episode, please share it with them. I truly believe these skills and tools that Alina taught to alleviate depression and anxiety could benefit so many people. And also, if you got value from this episode and want more, I would love for you to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a 5-star review on iTunes, because that means we can support even more people in rising higher together. And I've got a free gift for you. Because I believe that self-love is the key to everlasting happiness, unconditional love, and to having anything and everything you want, I have a special gift for all my listeners. It's a free self-love kickstart that will give you some powerful practices to get on your journey to owning your worth, rocking your confidence, and opening up to your own love to radically transform your life. And you can download that free gift that I created just for you at stephaniekwong.com/self-love-kickstart. And finally, for everything that we mentioned in today's episode, and for the cheat sheet download link, and for the links to connect with Alina, you can check it out in the show notes. And that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP8. You can check out all my other podcast episodes there too. And until next time, I'm sending you so much love.